volunteers, board of directors, show hosts, or other guests on the program.
Okay, this is Dave Mitchell with Radioactive Magazine, and today we are continuing our discussion with Ms. Pythia Pei, who is an award-winning author and journalist. Ms. Pei writes on the subjects of psychology, spirituality, and the American psyche, and we have been focusing on themes from her book, America on the Couch, Psychological Perspectives on American Politics and Culture, and how they relate to the great political struggle of our current election season. Ms. Pei, we are again greatly pleased to have you join us on our show today, Radioactive Magazine.
Well, I'm delighted to be here today to continue our conversation.
In his campaign for president, Donald Trump has fanned the flames of fear and paranoia towards immigrants, initially towards illegal Latino immigrants, insinuating many are rapists and criminals, with a promise to build a wall between the U.S. and Mexico. He has also called for a ban on all Muslims immigrating to the U.S., with a recent change to ban all Muslims from terrorist states. His campaign has resonated with many millions of Americans. On March 29, 2016, thedailywire.com reported a poll indicating, shockingly, that 50% of Americans supported the idea of a temporary ban on all Muslims traveling to the U.S. Fully 71% of Republicans and 34% of Democrats, amazingly enough, supported this idea. There is no doubt that America is a nation of immigrants, and part of our national identity is wrapped in the idea that people can come to our country, accept our values, become citizens, and participate in the American dream. Obviously, there is a great social struggle happening over who we are. In America on the Couch, your last section is entitled The Soul of America, and you include your interview with Edward Edinger, MD, author of Ego and Archetype, in that section. Despite the fact your interview with him was years ago, some of his observations seem particularly relevant to today's political turmoil. I'd like to read a few quotes from him from that interview. He said that American culture is a branch or outgrowth of Western civilization as a whole, but it's going through a crisis because it's lost its core religious mythology. That as the youngest living edge of Western civilization, America is going to manifest the phenomenon of the descent into chaos more quickly than older European aspects of civilization. He said, we're seeing this now in terms of violence and general disorganization and fragmentation. Part of it is a regression to anachronistic factional fundamentalisms of various kinds that start warring with each other. Can you expand on these themes from your interview with Edward Edinger and how they relate to our struggles in this election season over immigration and the Trump campaign?
Well, that's a great question, and I'm delighted that you've chosen to take a selection from an interview with Edward Edinger, who was one of the most profound, I think they were all profound thinkers, but he had a particular perspective on America that I found very deep. But I want to first begin to answer your question by also kind of going back over some of the territory that we have in other interviews, which is that I think we forget our own history as a nation of immigrants. I think, you know, from the beginning with the Puritans arriving on our shores as religious refugees from England, I mean, it hasn't always been the case that we've lived up to or have even wholly embraced our own ideal as a nation of immigrants. So that just like a person who holds up an ideal image of themselves, so I think that one of America's psychological patterns is that while we have a high opinion of ourselves as a nation that accepts immigrants with open arms, and while we uphold it as an ideal, which it is, the reality on the ground is often very difficult and complex. And so each wave of new immigrants, from the Irish to the Italians and the Chinese, has typically been greeted with hostility and suspicion. So this is a deep pattern. It's an old story. And we're seeing the same pattern repeat itself now as it's reflected in the paranoia among some segments, not all segments, but some segments of the American populace around Muslim immigrants. And Donald Trump is very effectively inflaming this part of the American psyche in the way that he's painting all Muslims in this country, I think, with the broad brush of terrorism. But at the same time, as it's often said, while we have our problems around immigration, and I'm hearing this a little bit more in the news these days, especially after Brexit, that America, quote, does immigration better than most countries because of our long and storied history around immigration, and because it's part of our purpose and our identity, and eventually most immigrants are able to assimilate into American culture, and many are able to do that while at the same time preserving their original traditions, which is what gives us such a rich culture. So in a way, I thought, is what happened in Great Britain with the Brexit vote in a way contradicts Edinger's comment in our interview that America would be the first nation to descend into violence and fragmentation around immigration. And it's in fact because of our identity as a nation of immigrants with open borders that at least so far we've proven more resilient in holding together in spite of the pressures caused by the diversity of our nation. And as I said, I heard this a lot on from news commentators after the Brexit vote, which was triggered by strong anti-immigrant sentiment, for instance. And many commentators, I heard this comment repeated, that who said that what had happened in England could not happen here because there are simply too many immigrants and they have too powerful of a voice. So I think that these recent events in Europe have had the kind of paradoxical effect of highlighting immigration as one of America's strengths. But to give a little more background into one of the other comments by Edward Edinger that you mentioned, that America is going through a crisis because it's lost its core religious mythology. That's something that historically has been something that's defined a country's national identity. What he was actually referring to was this historic process, and as he described it to me, it was very fascinating, that began during the Protestant Reformation, which was inspired by the idea that every individual should be able to have their own direct relationship to God, and a development that, according to him, was ultimately the way individualism got into American society, and that led to all the great freedoms that underpin our democracy, such as freedom of religion, so that people are free in our country to worship God or not in their own individual way, and which has led to this flourishing of different churches and denominations in America today. But at the same time, this part of America has also created a lot of dissidence and misunderstanding and frustration when new immigrants arrive here, arriving with more conservative beliefs and social customs, and they have a difficult time adjusting to our freedoms. I think as we saw in the case that I've read around the Orlando shooter, who I think was so offended by our social freedoms.
These historical forces of resistance to immigration are not confined to the U.S., as evidenced by the U.K. referendum vote, the Brexit vote, which you've already mentioned. Donald Trump has highly praised the outcome of this vote. What observations do you have on the fact that Donald Trump has highly praised this vote? What parallels can you draw between the Brexit vote and what's going on in the U.S.?
Well, I think that the Brexit vote very handily played right into Donald Trump's hands in terms of his being able to manipulate people's fears and paranoia around immigration. But what I found interesting to note is that not only did Donald Trump praise the Brexit vote, so did Putin in Russia, and so did China. And I think that says something about what many people suspect and intuit about Donald Trump, and that is that part of his underlying psychology is a tendency away from democracy and individualism, with all the pressures that that brings, all the responsibilities that it brings around diversity and differences, and toward authoritarianism, conformity, and fascism, and all the things that go along with that, such as closed borders and lack of a free press, which Donald Trump recently in the news also has been disallowing certain media outlets like the Washington Post to cover him during his press conferences. So that's very undemocratic. And It reflects a kind of defensiveness and restrictiveness that spurs him to want to build a wall as a kind of protection against the unknown and the unexpected. And so, as so many others than me have said, this goes counter to all our American ideals. It's un-American. And yet, at the same time, Donald Trump is revealing the shadow of those ideals and the difficulty with those ideals and how some people lack the capacity to stand behind those ideals. But I found a wonderful quote from Jung that speaks, I think, to the psychological dynamics underlying the paranoia around immigrants and immigration, as we see it stirred up by Donald Trump. And this quote is, "It is not the conscious subject, but the unconscious which does the projecting. Hence, one meets with projections, one does not make them. The effect of projection is to isolate the subject from his environment, since instead of a real relationship to it, there is now only an illusory one. Projections turn the world into the replica of one's unknown face, and by means of this vicious circle, the isolation is intensified." So that with Donald Trump, to speculate, his inner states of paranoia and mistrust and need for control get projected onto the politics of immigration. And that's where I think psychology and a kind of psychological analysis of Donald Trump and even other presidential candidates is so important. I also found myself thinking of the psychological term of displacement, which means that as a way for a person not to deal with something that's troubling them or stirring things up in their psyche, they instead fasten their attention onto something else as a way of avoiding something they don't want to deal with. So another way to look at Trump's obsession with immigration and immigrants and borders and building walls is as a displacement for something else he's not dealing with. And those are the enormous problems facing our country, like the economy, for instance, and climate change. And these are very complex issues, as is immigration. And Trump so far has not shown any talent or ability for dealing with complexity. And his tendency is always to simplify things. And if you watch that press conference that he gave from his golf course in the aftermath, the immediate aftermath of Brexit, Trump is a master of displacement, as he immediately turned the press's attention to his new hotel and golf course.
But it's not just that he engages in these processes. I mean, there are millions of Americans who feel resonance with the statements that he's making, particularly the displacement statements around Latino immigrants, illegal Latino immigrants, mm-hmm. and Muslim travelers and immigrants. And there's a big problem there. There's some powerful process going on here collectively.
Well, there is a powerful process. And I think, in a way, Donald Trump in some way could be said to be doing us a favor in that he's revealing this part of America and the American psyche. And as I said at the outset, we have this ideal around immigration, and yet on the ground, it's always a continual work in progress. It's not so easy. And I think that's what Donald Trump embodies. He embodies the regressive parts of ourselves that, while as liberal as we want to be, as progressive as we want to be, there are still regressive parts of the American culture that hold us back and that I think we ignore to our peril. We have to know ourselves as a country.
There is a process where we have to continually renew our values and live up to them.
That's exactly right, and that's a wonderful way to put it. Mm-hmm. These are tests. The American experiment and the American process is continually tested, and we're always in danger of losing our democracy. And Donald Trump, clearest example of that than I've seen in many decades, is he represents a real threat to the democratic process.
My sense of things is that he creates a lot of emotion on both sides.
Right, he does. Well, the good news is his poll numbers actually plummeted after his remarks on Brexit and other issues. So,
right. There was a quote by Edward Edinger about America that I'd like to read, and he said that America is a microcosm of the world. He states, "We're America is the last best hope of the world. We really are, and if we don't make it, the world hasn't got a chance. And if we do make it, then the world has a model that makes it likely that it can make it too. It's a big deal as I see it. And he made this statement. Was that interview? That was some time ago.
That was 20 years ago.
20 years ago.
And it was the first interview that I did for my book, and I used it as I included it as the very last interview in my book in the chapter on the soul of America, because I thought his vision was so beautiful for America, and I had never heard it articulated in quite that way that he did. And I think it has particular relevance today for the situation that we're in. And as he explained to me a little more in our conversation, world history, as he said, has as its goal unification, and that means political and psychological unification. And so he said, we're an advanced laboratory for that kind of unification because we're the one nation that on principle, so that on principle we are a nation of immigrants, and that on principle we've turned ourselves into a microcosm of the world as a whole with the most open borders of any nation in the world. And so, as he pointed out to me, we have these little communities all over the United States that represent every major ethnic and national entity in the whole world, so that when something goes on in another country, there's a demonstration in front of the White House, Ettinger said, for that particular community. And he said, this is why our national motto, our country's motto, is E Pluribus Unum, and it means from the many, one. And he said, this is why we're the last best hope of the world, because if we are able to come together and under the pressures presented by immigration, presented by diversity and people of different faiths and diets and dress, mingling together people of different customs, if somehow we can do that under what he called the pain and pressures of diversity and immigration, then he said the world has a model that says they can make it too, that the whole world can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a vision, I think, obviously, that will take some many centuries after my lifetime to come to fruition. But as a citizen, I took Ettinger's words to heart. And it meant, in the smallest of ways, if I'm on the phone with somebody who has a heavy accent that I can't understand, or I'm being served in a restaurant by a person whose accent is different, or I walk down the street and I pass by people with headscarves or robes or mm-hmm. who have customs that are different from mine, I take it as my now democratic responsibility to our diverse but United States of America to do all that I can to encounter, to hold that encounter with difference and diversity
right.
as something sacred, as my
right.
sake, as a kind of civic duty.
Right.
And so in doing that, I'm doing something of greater historic importance that lives beyond my own individual life.
Right. This is the challenge and the struggle that we're, a great challenge and struggle that we're going through right now.
Exactly.
In this political season.
It's just not framed often for us. But I think, as I said, what happened after the Brexit vote, when Europe made that stunning decision to separate and to break up the European Union, which was a great shock to a lot of people, because you could feel, as Donald Trump thought that was a great thing, that could happen here.
Uh-huh.
And
right.
And I think that it's one more urgent reminder for us of what a precious legacy we have with
uh-huh.
our nation
right.
of diversity and okay. a nation of immigrants from around the world, and that we don't want to lose that.
Right. We have run out of time for
okay.
this particular episode, and we will look forward to our next installment with you. Well, so thank you very much for being on the show today, Radioactive Magazine, and we will talk with you soon.
Thank you. Always a pleasure, Dave. I enjoy it very
okay.
much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Those just joining us, you are listening to Radioactive Magazine. And thank you, Dave, for that great interview that we just heard. Our next guest is Teresa Molly, and she has been a member of the Notre Dame Sisters for 60 years, and she has been an activist trying to repeal the death penalty and has worked with Missourians for the alternatives to the death penalty for more than 20 years now. And so we are here with her, and I think we'll start out with the, if you can tell us about the event tomorrow, and then we'll get into some of this other stuff. That way we'll make sure we have all the information for tomorrow's event.
Well, tomorrow's event, we're remembering a historic day in the United States. 44 years ago, on June 29th, which of course is tomorrow, the Supreme Court made the decision that there could be no more executions. They had taken on a case in Georgia, Furman versus Georgia, which led to the court to decide that the death penalty was being applied unfairly, and as they said, in an arbitrary and capricious manner, and so they said this cannot go on. So that day in 72 was a day of celebration for us.
Okay, and then since then they've reinstated the death penalty.
It was reinstated 4 years later on July 2nd. The court took another case from Georgia, which reversed this decision, so states could resume executions if they wanted to, and they did not hesitate doing so. And Missouri, of course, was one of them. Missouri didn't start right away in 1976, but in 1989 they began their executions, and we have been at it ever since. So this fast, they're having a fast and vigil. We are doing this fast and vigil in solidarity with abolitionists in Washington, D.C., who do this every year. Every year between June 29th and July 1st, they go to the Supreme Court building, in front of the Supreme Court building, for 4 days. So we are going to be in solidarity with them tomorrow in front of the Jackson City Courthouse from 11 to 1 o'clock.
And for those who don't know where Jackson County Courthouse is, that's on 12th Street between Oak. Well, it's by 12th and Oak. Forget what the other cross street is. And what are you looking for people to do or accomplish at this vigil?
Well, what we're going to do, we're basically going to try and call attention to the death penalty and the wrongness of it. We will basically be standing there, and if people talk to us, that would be good, and we have some information to give them. And so whoever comes, and it's going to be during the lunch hour, so there will probably be a little more traffic. So hopefully we can get some awareness and some attention to the issue. That's kind of one of the goals of MADP, is to call attention to the issue of the death penalty, to educate on the topic, and to advocate to our legislators for the abolition of the death penalty.
Okay. And in Missouri, you talked about when the Supreme Court had struck down death penalty and then resumed it. So since 1976, how many people have been executed in Missouri?
In Missouri alone, 86 people have been executed. In the United States, since that time, almost 1,400 have been executed. And we are, as many people know, the United States is one of the few more up-and-coming countries that is doing the death penalty anymore. The EU, Europe, they won't even let people join the EU unless they're opposed to the death penalty. So we are definitely in a minority here in the United States.
And what about North America? Does Canada? I think Canada does not have death penalty. About Mexico?
I don't think so, but I don't know that.
All right.
I don't know that in North America and Mexico.
And one of the reasons why MADP is against death penalty, from my understanding, is because of the risk of innocent people being executed. How many people have been exonerated in Missouri?
In Missouri, there have been four people that have been exonerated. They spent many years, each of them, on death row for a crime they did not commit. So that's a lot of years and a lot of life wasted for those four people.
And then nationwide, has it passed the 200 mark yet?
I don't think it passed 200. I think it's close to 180.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's getting up there, finding out how many innocent people have been put on death row and been wrongly accused.
And I think to clarify things, we only talk about how many people have been exonerated that were on death row. But nationwide, the total exonerees who included for old crimes have been over 2,000 people now.
Oh, at least over 2,000.
Right.
Yep. Yes, for sure.
So that just goes to, why it's so alarming and how easy it is for somebody to be locked up for something it turns out they haven't done.
That's correct. Certainly is.
And of course, once somebody's executed, it doesn't help but to exonerate because you've taken their life already.
That's correct. Okay. Some people think victims' families all want whoever killed their son, daughter, their loved one to have the death penalty, but that is definitely not always the case. In fact, there are many that have advocated against the death penalty. Because it won't bring their loved one back, and it'll simply create another family, victim's family, by executing someone else and killing someone else. It's
right.
A vicious circle.
So we're at the end of our time. Before we cut that off, though, is there a website people can go to for more information?
Yes, madpmo.org. That's madpmo.org. And the other place you can go is Death Penalty Information Center. Just put it in your search engine, and it'll bring you the Death Penalty Information site. And they are the most comprehensive, have the most comprehensive information, and they have state by state, and they can lead you to what Missouri's statistics are, along with everybody else.
All right. So I want to thank you for joining us. For those just joining us, you've been listening to Therese Molly, and we've been talking about the death penalty. And if you want more information about the vigil tomorrow, you can go to the website she just stated. Thank you.
August 2nd is Election Day in Kansas and Missouri. You can register to vote until July 6th in Missouri and July 12th in Kansas. Voters in Missouri can download sample ballots from the websites of their county boards of election commissioners. In Jackson County, that's kceb.org. Kansas voters must wait until 20 days prior to the election to see a sample ballot. Johnson County voters can get a sample ballot after July 12th from jocoelections.org. Brief biographies of major candidates, including voting records for incumbents and campaign finance, are available from votesmart.org, ballotpedia.org, opensecrets.org, and followthemoney.org. I'm Spencer Graves, and I believe we should make politics our primary entertainment. The total of all the goods and services produced per person in the United States has doubled 5 times since 1800 as measured by gross domestic product per capita. It will continue to grow and benefit everyone if we get our politics right. The obstacles to broadly shared progress are political, not technological. You can help by educating yourself and voting. The big money do not want you to vote. If you do vote, they want you ignorant. Print out your sample ballot and mark it up while researching it on the web and discussing it with anyone who will listen. Campaign finance is important because there's a high correlation between funding and official behaviors of incumbent politicians. The Center for Public Integrity conducted state integrity investigations in 2012 and 2015. Kansas got an F and Missouri a D- last year. If you act early, you can ask your candidates about their positions on transparency in government and about these integrity investigations. This is my opinion. It is not the official position of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, to which you are listening.
A look back at political conventions from FDR in 1936 to the battles inside and outside the 1968 Chicago Convention to the radical sounds of rage against the machine in the LA streets in 2000. On From the Vault, Wednesday morning at 5. KKFI closes out Pride Month with From Stonewall to Today on Sprouts, Thursday at noon.
Pair Excellence 3, locally yours. A beer pairing with Anton's Tap Room and Cinderblock Brewing Company. At Anton's Tap Room on July 21st at 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. This five-course dinner will feature pairings from the chef at Anton's and the head brewer of Cinderblock, specifically paired to bring out the best aspects of each course. Locally brewed and locally grown, July 21st, this beer pairing dinner is at Anton's Tap Room at 1610 Main Street, Kansas City, Missouri. Reserve your seat today at kkfi.org/events. All proceeds benefit 90.1 FM KKFI.
Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, in her forceful dissent from a ruling on the admissibility of illegally obtained evidence, Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor said the decision implies that you are not a citizen of a democracy, but the subject of a carceral state, just waiting to be cataloged. The defendant in Utah versus Streiff is white, but the suspicionless stops at the case's heart disproportionately affect black and brown and poor people, marginalized in media as elsewhere. The press are now quoting Sotomayor's words, but do they really hear the message? Neeraj Sekhon is associate professor at Georgia State University College of Law. He'll join us to discuss the ruling. Also on the show, though corporate media often use the terms electorate and public interchangeably, the truth is people don't cease to be political when they don't vote. That elision erases a lot of people, from those truly opting out of the process to people excluded or discouraged from it for a variety of reasons worthy of exploration. Our guest asks what it would mean to shift focus from resisting the chipping away of voting rights to pushing for robust expansion of the franchise. Jamila Michener is assistant professor in the Department of Government at Cornell University. She'll talk with us about that. All of that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press. The suspect in the murder of British Labour MP Joe Cox had ties to a U.S. neo-Nazi organization, The Washington Post reported June 17th. Citing the Southern Poverty Law Center, the Post said the assailant was a longtime supporter of the National Alliance. Founded in 1974 by William Pierce, an associate of American Nazi Party leader George Lincoln Rockwell, the group was a reorganization of the National Youth Alliance, itself an outgrowth of Youth for Wallace, coming out of segregationist George Wallace's 1968 presidential campaign. While head of the National Alliance, Pierce published The Turner Diaries, a novel that portrays, favorably, a guerrilla race war and the mass murder of Jews, gay people, and interracial couples. A chapter depicting the bombing of an FBI building served as inspiration for the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing that killed 168 people. Timothy McVeigh had Xeroxed highlighted pages in his car, and he called a National Alliance phone number 7 times the day before. That didn't make the group a household name, though. Once it was clear that media's initial assumption that the bombing was the work of Middle Eastern terrorists was wrong, they lost interest in ideological motivation. So there was no dot to connect in 2011 when a former National Alliance member in Spokane, Washington, planted a bomb filled with shrapnel and rat poison at the Martin Luther King Day parade. It was defused, and he's serving a 32-year prison sentence. Most corporate media consumers didn't hear about that at all. Fair's Steve Rendell noted at the time, it got 3 mentions on the nightly news in the 10 weeks that followed, compared, just for the heck of it, with 49 mentions given in that same time frame to the much less sophisticated Times Square bomb that failed to go off a year earlier, in which the perpetrator was said to have ties to the Pakistani Taliban. Longtime Counterspin listeners may remember the National Alliance as a favorite of New York talk show host Bob Grant, whose influential show aired for years on WABC, ABC Radio Network's flagship station. Grant, who regularly hosted politicians like Rudy Giuliani and George Pataki, was an open racist and homophobe, whom corporate media insisted on describing as curmudgeonly. Grant called black people subhumanoids and savages. He hosted white subway vigilante Bernard Goetz, who shot 4 black teenagers, and complained that Goetz hadn't, quote, finished the job by killing them all, close quote. After a gay pride parade, Grant declared, quote, ideally it would have been nice to have a few phalanxes of policemen with machine guns and mow them down, close quote. You get the idea. Curmudgeonly. Well, Grant was a big promoter of the National Alliance. He'd let callers talking about white Americans concerned about the future of their race give out contact information over the air. But even when Disney bought WABC and Grant was eventually let go, after African-American Commerce Secretary Ron Brown's plane went down over Bosnia, Grant worried on air that Brown might not be dead, media still weren't interested in the neo-Nazi group he loved so well. Which is only to say that the lack of curiosity about the influence of the violent far right is a tradition in U.S. corporate media. Don't expect the murder of Joe Cox to change that. And finally, everyone should have access to the same internet content. That, as Lisa Lynch reminded on Fair.org, is the principle that guided last year's FCC decision to reclassify high-speed internet as a utility, subject to the same kinds of regulation as electricity, landline phone service, or other utilities that serve the public good. That was the argument for net neutrality, but it was opposed by ISPs and cable companies, who want a world in which internet content can be filtered and throttled for profit, not to put too fine a point on it. Even before the ink was dry on the FCC's Title II reclassification, the ISPs took the FCC to court, claiming the agency had overstepped its bounds. This week, the D.C. Circuit Court took the FCC's side, agreeing that broadband internet's role as the conduit to the content shaping everyday experience made reclassification a sensible choice. Over the past 2 decades, the judges wrote, this content has transformed nearly every aspect of our lives, from profound actions like choosing a leader, building a career, and falling in love, to more quotidian ones like hailing a cab and watching a movie. In other words, the court agreed that reclassifying the internet is a step forward, a way to recognize profound changes that have occurred in the media landscape since the emergence of the web. So, amid a number of regressive developments, we should take a moment to appreciate not just a forward-looking move, but a linchpin one, crucial to our ability to talk to one another around media gatekeepers and to work on all of the other challenges we face. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. From the media accolades for Sonia Sotomayor's dissent in a recent Supreme Court case involving the use of illegally obtained evidence, it's almost unclear if media realized that the ruling represents a loss for her point of view. With a 5-3 decision in the case, Utah versus Streif, the court said that a police officer may detain someone without cause and run their identification, and if they uncover a warrant, may arrest them and charge them with additional crimes based on what they find in a search. Previously, the fact that the initial stop was illegal would mean evidence unearthed would be inadmissible. Sotomayor, Kagan, and Ginsburg dissented, with Sotomayor especially powerfully noting the disproportionate impact the ruling will have on communities of color. The dissents are worth reading in full. They raise a lot of questions about the court's understanding of how the Fourth Amendment, and indeed the law, is applied in the real world. Joining us now to help us understand the ruling and its potential effects is Neeraj Sekhon. He's associate professor at Georgia State University College of Law. He joins us now by phone from Atlanta. Welcome to Counterspin, Neeraj Sekhon.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what is the significance of Utah versus Streif for everyone, but in particular for communities of color? How would you explain it?
I think the good news is that it's not actually going to dramatically affect police practices in minority communities. The bad news is that police practices in minority communities are deplorable. Right? Minority communities bear the brunt of police abuses and excesses, as we already know. And I read Streif less as cutting new legal ground and more as just underscoring or highlighting or putting an exclamation point behind the extent to which the court is really kind of disinterested in the realities of policing in minority communities.
I've been a little bit bemused, you could say, by the tone of some coverage that suggests that Sotomayor's, in particular's, dissent was personal, as though it were qualified, but in an approved way. You know, there's a sense that she's putting a sassy Latina touch on the law, you know, rather than what you're referring to, interpreting law with regard to lived experience. I mean, isn't that really what we would hope any judge would do, is interpret the law according to how life is lived?
Well, one would hope. I think it's important to note that Justice Sotomayor takes issue not just with the result in the Streif opinion, but with the results in a range of Fourth Amendment opinions. I mean, she's going back almost a generation and looking at Fourth Amendment law as it has evolved since the 1970s and making the point, as many have, that the Fourth Amendment hasn't been interpreted in a manner that allows for courts to respond to the realities of policing in minority communities. And so I think that Streif was, she's reacting to it as the proverbial straw, right? I mean, it's symbolizing kind of a broader refusal to address the systemic injustices that are sort of endemic to police search and seizure practices in minority communities.
Well, and let me ask you, in arguments around stop and frisk, we often hear law enforcement say, essentially, well, we stop more black people because they commit more crimes, you know? And then the pushback sometimes amounts to, well, we just don't like that impact, you know? But there is a way to get at how police policies can be unfair, but you have to pull back from this focus that we tend to have on the individual encounter between the citizen and the police officer. I wonder, could you tell us in simple terms about the idea of departmental discretion? What does that get at?
And I can use a moment in the Streif opinion to do that. In the majority opinion written by Justice Thomas, there's a line in which he suggests that a warrant, an outstanding warrant, is essentially a directive to police to make an arrest. And of course, that's true at some sort of abstract level, but a warrant really creates discretion to arrest. And police officers ignore criminal law violations, they ignore warrants all of the time, to the extent that officers are being sent to particular neighborhoods to maximize street stops. I mean, that's an example of departmental discretion. Officers understand their responsibility, their mandate to be to stop people in the street and to ask them questions and to assist them, and for whatever purpose, it might be to interdict drugs, it might be to interdict weapons. The fault doesn't in any simple way lie with individual officers in those kinds of cases. I mean, I think there's other examples of departmental discretion as well, but I think we're too often tend to focus on individual cases, individual encounters, at the expense of thinking more broadly and systematically about how police departments make policy, how they imagine enforcement priorities, and the manner in which they direct their officers to affect those policy choices. And the Fourth Amendment has evolved in such a way that the Supreme Court isn't really putting any pressure on police departments to do anything differently.
Well, not to hammer the point home too hard, but, you know, years ago when I was working in the financial district, I used to think, if you set up a checkpoint in this hallway and checked every person for cocaine, you know, you could hit your quota in 15 minutes. You know, it's a matter of where law enforcement is, you know. So when we hear the argument that, oh, we're just trying to find crime wherever it is, you're saying, well, there's choices are being made beyond the level of an individual officer that have an impact on who gets arrested.
To the extent that, let's just use the checkpoint example that you just articulated, to the extent that some hypothetical department elects to set up checkpoints exclusively in minority neighborhoods, there's no Fourth Amendment claim that can be brought to challenge any discrimination that may be inherent in that choice. The court is pretty explicitly taken racial selectivity, racial disparity off the table, the constitutional table, that is, insofar as Fourth Amendment claims go. That was in a case called Wren, the case from the 90s. And Justice Sotomayor explicitly references that case. So her upset, again, is not just about the result in Streis, but she's very much looking at Streis as just another moment in this long-standing judicial disinterest or hostility, really, to conceptualizing or engaging with the problems confronted by minority communities as Fourth Amendment issues.
Let me ask you, finally, media seem to have made a place, Black Lives Matter and social media and others have forced a place, if you will, for these questions that we haven't seen for some time. If you could change something about media coverage of this set of issues that you work on, or if you could see more of something or less of something else, what would that be?
Well, I think it goes back to a theme that you have mentioned a couple of times. I know that individual sensationalist individual cases are the ones that capture eyeballs, but I think the preoccupation with the sensationalist case, I think, leads the public to think that problems of, or at least some significant segment of the public, it leads them to believe that the problems of race and policing are reducible to questions of individual bias, right? The bad cop, the bad racist cop who harbors racist animosity and malevolence for minorities. And I think that we really need to start thinking about how police bureaucracies make choices, how they make enforcement choices, how they prioritize particular enforcement choices, and the kinds of practices and protocols that they use. It's a much less juicy, headline-getting approach to the question, but I think it would be more constructive and useful if more members of the media were willing to engage with these questions at that level of determination.
We've been speaking with Neeraj Sekhon of Georgia State University College of Law. Thank you very, very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Well, thank you for including us. Happy to be a part of the conversation.
Judging by the amount of coverage alone, you'd have to assume that corporate media take elections extremely seriously. But if journalists believe so strongly in the electoral process, why are they more interested in efforts to expand participation in it? Higher voting turnouts would serve, one would think, to justify media's implied premise that elections merit attention as a legitimate, if flawed, reflection of the public interest and will. Jamila Michener is assistant professor in the Department of Government at Cornell, working on the politics of poverty and racial inequality in the United States. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Jamila Michener.
Thank you.
Well, your piece on American Prospects website is headlined Playing Offense on Voting Rights. It's based on the paper Race, Poverty, and the Redistribution of Voting Rights, which appears in the June issue of the Journal of Poverty and Public Policy. listeners will know there are things for voting rights advocates to defend against. We're seeing restrictions around, for example, ID requirements that were green-lighted by the Supreme Court's weakening of the Voting Rights Act. You're not saying don't do that defense, but just that it's a mistake to stop there?
Absolutely. The defense is clearly critical in the particular political milieu that we're in, but there's a lot more to thinking about voting rights than that. Part of the reason why offense is really important is because right now participation in our democracy is really skewed, and there are specific populations that are marginal, low-income folk, folks who have disabilities, people of color who are both affected by policies in specific ways that make them more vulnerable and who participate in some cases, less in the political process. And so there's this cycle where the people whom the policies affect most acutely are not having a voice in the political process that produces those policies. And that's a problem.
It's almost like a self-tightening knot.
Yes.
Well, this has been recognized, and it's led to the creation of a couple of tools. The question your work suggests has to do, in part at least, with implementation.
Yes, so this is really important. I'm always astonished in just my regular, everyday conversations with people that when I talk about legislative tools that we have for increasing participation in the political system, that there's not as widespread knowledge of these as I think there should be. And so when I mention the National Voting Rights Act to people, first of all, they're amazed that anything like this could ever have passed. But the 1990s were a different time when Congress was doing more, for better or worse, than they're doing now. And Section 5 is the motor voter component that lots of people know about. It's the reason why when you go to the DMV, you're asked to vote. But Section 7 is a component that very few people know, that the same thing is supposed to happen when you go to public assistance agencies. You're supposed to be asked to vote when you apply for food assistance, when you apply for medical assistance, for any sort of aid from the government. And although it's supposed to happen, all of the evidence that we have suggests that it's not happening and that some states are kind of worse perpetrators, worse at complying with this law. What my research focuses on is why. Why wouldn't states comply with a law that's supposed to make our democracy better?
Well, I think as you describe who it would be reaching out to and including, listeners can start to think of reasons that people might not necessarily want to, not to be too cynical, but to include those folks. But let's talk, because it might be something people would guess about, but you've actually looked at, you know, what is compliance look like and what are the different factors that seem to affect compliance with Section 7, and what did you find?
I thought precisely in the way that you just outlined, which is, well, who's going to be brought into the electorate by this law? And the answer is low-income people, people living in poverty. Because of the intersection between race and poverty, disproportionately people of color. And also because many people who have disabilities and who have other life challenges interact with government agencies, those folks. And so in particular around race and poverty, I thought, well, there are political implications to bringing low-income people and people of color into the electorate. So I paid a lot of attention to what role race played in the process. And so I found ways of measuring the extent to which states were complying with this law. And there was a lot of variation across states and even over time, mm-hmm. but the states that were doing the worst were the states that had the largest share of their population that was black. Right. So states that had many African Americans relative to other racial groups actually did a consistently worse job of complying. And also states where not just the population consisted of African Americans, but when African Americans and other folks of color did not participate in politics, so when they didn't have as much political power, when they weren't registered to vote as at high rates relative to whites in that state, that's when politicians were, or it appears that there was very little accountability and very little effort on the part of political elites to comply with this law.
I've seen some scoffing at proactive registration efforts, and not just kind of a line that, oh, it's just Democrats and people who believe in big government, you know, which ties in, of course, with the Section 7 stuff, but also this idea represented by a letter to the editor in the Eagle Tribune, I think in Wichita, Kansas, that said, well, why not go all the way and have the state cast their votes for them? You know, it's this idea that voting is a privilege, and if you don't jump through whatever hoops exist for you, wherever you're situated, then you don't want it bad enough, and therefore you don't deserve it.
The thing that political scientists, people who study politics like I do, are well aware of is that the hoops aren't the same for everyone, and that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Lowering the barriers to voting, you might think we're making it too easy, and why should something so important be easy? But it's really an issue that it's so much harder for some folks than others. If we think about the low-income population and the number of barriers that they face in terms of having working hours that are different, that make it more difficult to find the time to register or vote, in terms of having less access to childcare, less access to transportation, even less access to discussion networks, mm-hmm. to people around you who are talking about voting, who are saying, hey, and I went and registered today, did you? They're further away from DMVs, so the motor vehicle agencies where most of us are getting registered, they're not close to those places. You know, I think if most Americans are honest with themselves, they would admit that they usually register to vote in incidental ways because they've moved and so they filled out that form at the post office, or because they went to get their driver's license so they checked that box. Most of us aren't jumping through hoops to register to vote. For most of us, it's easy. But that's not the case for low-income people, especially low-income people of color who live in urban areas, or low-income whites who live in isolated rural areas. And why should those folks have less access to the franchise unless they jump through more hoops than the rest of us to be able to vote? It's really unfair.
It's hard to overstate the problem with seeing democracy as being defined by a process that, you know, hey, if some folks can't get themselves into it, that's just how it is. I remember reading years ago, lots of polling places aren't accessible by wheelchair. And, you know, hey, oops, you know, like you should have figured that out and filled out a form and mailed it in earlier. I'm talking about the way the question is presented. And I guess what I want to ask you finally is, what we really want to do is expand participation in the franchise.
Yeah.
But there's also something to be said for at least naming the issue. If we aren't going to do that, we should at least acknowledge that when we talk about the democratic process and the electorate wants this and the public wants this, we should at least put a big asterisk next to that.
That's absolutely true. I mean, even when legislation passes and there's this sense that this is now the law of the land and we should accept it, but thinking about the process that produced that law and whose voice mattered, right? It really affects how we view the legitimacy of policies and of laws. And so, yeah, absolutely being straightforward about what the kind of gaps and the inequalities and the holes in the system are is really important. And it's important for changing anything. And in part, that's driven by the folks on your end, right? The journalists who are responsible for, to a certain extent, right? Not entirely, but to a large extent, responsible for shaping what the public knows about and what they don't. And it's amazing how little these issues of unequal access come up. And even when we see them in the media, it's not clear what the policy roots of these problems are. Folks focus on it as an individual problem. Well, low-income people just won't go and vote. They won't do what it takes. But not as a structural problem that's about transportation or disability access or ability to get childcare so that you can get to that polling place without having to worry about what's happening with your children. And so I think if those aspects of the barriers were emphasized more effectively, it would give people a different story than the story of, well, either you do it on your own or you're at fault.
We've been speaking with Jamila Michener of Cornell University's Department of Government. Her adapted article, Playing Offense on Voting Rights, can be found online at prospect.org. Jamila Michener, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes and Erica Bassett. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Damas y caballeros, de parte de todos los miembros del Grupo Momento, es un gran honor, and with great respect, que les trajemos un poquito de some of our favorite artists who have inspired us throughout the years para traerles nuestra música. Para todos ustedes, a taste of Tejano.